Okay. Backup recorder is working. So, thank you for inviting me back, and especially for the year-concluding program. Is everyone Jewish in the time of Mashiach? That's the headline at the top of the page. You may have heard this. It's a joke I heard many, many years ago. The story of three people. There's a Jewish fellow, and there's a Muslim fellow, and there's a fill in the blank. I don't know, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever you like, who pass away, and they go up to be judged. And the first one in, let's say it's the Muslim fellow, is asked, you know, various questions, and you know, comes out as a good person, and is told, okay, you know, you get to go to heaven down the hall, you know, to the left. Just be careful, be quiet as you pass room 12. And people have heard this before?
No.
Okay, some people have heard this before. Be quiet as you pass room 12. And okay, fine. Goes down the hall, it's quiet, passing room 12, makes a left, fine. And then if next one up, I don't know, a Hindu woman, also, you know, interviewed, passes the test, is told, also, you get to go into heaven, you know, down the hall, quiet as you pass room 12, and then make a left at the end. And that's what she does, and great. And then, after that is a Jewish woman, and also, same thing, set of questions, does okay, and is told, okay, you know, down the hall, and you know, quiet as you pass room 12, and make a left. And she says, I just have to ask you, you know, who's in room 12? What's the story of room 12? Oh, those are the Catholics. They think they're alone. I say that not in any way, shape, or form to mock or bash any particular religious group. That's not my goal. But there is a sense, a popular sense, that some religions are more accepting of the idea that that a broad range of people can make it into heaven, and some have a very narrow view of what one must believe or do in order to make it into heaven. Judaism tends to be on the liberal end of things. The Talmud already notes that everybody has a shot, whether you are Jewish, whether you are not Jewish. Yes, there are certain expectations God has for people. Killing is a good way to you know, get left out, for example. However, if you follow certain basic rules, you can make it in. There's some dispute. How righteous do you have to be? And what exactly do you have to follow? Judaism has a complicated system, because with us, everything is complicated, for you know what happens after someone passes away. But basically, Judaism is of the belief that everybody has a shot, whether they're Jewish or not. But that's not the question this morning. The question this morning is the time of Mashiach, the time of the Messiah, which we're going to have to define a little bit better shortly. But is a Jewish vision of it that everybody continues as they were? So Jews are Jews, and Catholics are Catholics, and Protestants are Protestants, and Muslims are Muslims, and so on. Or, opposite extreme, is the view that everybody accepts Judaism. That a Mashiach comes, and everybody becomes Jewish. Now, in order to really address this, we have to ask, what in the world is this messianic time? What is this time of Mashiach that we're talking about? And, of course, you know that, once again, it's complicated. We have a lot of debates, starting with the fact that within Tanakh, within Jewish scripture, we have all sorts of predictions of what's going to happen in what is often called Be'acharit HaYamim, at the end of days. The Tanakh can't stop talking about what's going to happen at that stage in the future, whether it's the rebuilding of a temple, the return of Jews to the land of Israel, prophecy worldwide for all human beings. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But the messages sometimes conflict. Two points, though, are particularly worth highlighting. And if you take a look at your sheet, you'll see what I'm talking about. First, a source from the Talmud. It's actually mentioned a couple of places in the Talmud I brought you. One of them, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba quoted Rabbi Yochanan. Does anyone have sheets? Okay? Good. Thank you. All of the prophets only prophesied about the time of Mashiach, the Messiah. Incidentally, anyone know what the word Mashiach actually means? It doesn't mean Messiah. What does the word actually mean?
Anointed.
Someone said it? Anointed, right. One who is anointed. The practice going back to King Saul, the first official Jewish king, was that a king would have oil put on his head. Yes, that was considered a good thing. And that act of anointing was a designation of the person in that role of being the servant of God as the king. So Mashiach is one who is anointed. So there is some era that all the prophets saw coming, but then there's something else called the world to come. In Hebrew, that is called Olam Haba, right? And no one has seated God other than you, based on a verse in Isaiah. So that's one view. Then you have the different view of sage by the name of Shmuel, who says, no, there is no difference between this world, that of Mashiach, other than the tyranny of empires. In other words, the first view says that all of the prophecies, which talk about different things happening in a future time, are all about one era, called the time of Mashiach, and then there's going to be another one, after that, presumably, called Olam Haba, and other things are going to happen then, and we don't know what that's going to look like. That's one view. And then the second view says, no, the period of Mashiach is pretty straightforward. There's no real difference between this world and that one, except nations shall not rule over other nations, right? No war is waged in that time, which sounds pretty good. But that's only a first stage, and then other prophecies are fulfilled in a second stage. So my first point at this stage, it's okay. Maybe in the world to come, there will be no ringtones. I don't know what to say. But this is life for now, when we deal with it. The first stage is, or not sorry, Christmas. The first point that I want to make is that there are multiple stages in the Jewish vision of the Messianic time, without having to decide what's happening in which stage. I just want to note that, because it's going to be important later on. The second one is, if you take a look in source number 2, I brought it from a verse in Daniel. There are various verses I could have brought you. This is something called in Hebrew, Tchiyat HaMeitim. Tchiyat HaMeitim means? The revival of the dead, right? We avoid saying the resurrection, because others have a trademark on that. But it is the revival of the dead. Granted, we were here first, but we didn't go to the copyright office. We didn't register it. They took it, and it's gone. We could have litigated, but and many of those who sleep in the dirt will awaken, and these for eternal life, and these for humiliation and eternal shame. It speaks of a day of judgment. So you have broad extremes in terms of the predictions of what will be. Right? You have on the one hand the idea the next world is pretty much like this one, just no war. And then you have one of people who have died actually coming back. So, quite a range there. But now that we know a little bit, and like really like the smallest bit, about what is supposed to be predicted for that time, we know that there are different eras, and we know that there are different predictions. Some are more mundane, some are more extreme. But now, let's ask the question. Would you think, based on what you know of Torah, what you know of Judaism, would you think that the anticipation is that the world converts to Judaism, or that people continue with whatever religious affiliation they had, or something else entirely? I'm asking you, what do you think it looks like? And you're going to have to support your view.
So we live and let live, and you do yours, and let us do ours.
So one school of thought would be to suggest that we are not evangelizing religion. We, as a matter of fact, and we'll see it later, discourage people when they approach us to convert. The first response is supposed to be, why? What in the world would make you want to do that? So within that school of thought, we'd say, we're not looking for converts now, we're not looking for converts then. And therefore, people will do whatever they wish to do, and that's one approach. Yeah?
I would think that if you follow the laws of Noah, then everybody is entitled to the world to come.
So Marlene suggests we have seven Noahide laws. There are actually more than seven, but they're always called seven. Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. There are laws that are supposed to apply to all human beings. Example, again, I mentioned it before, not to commit murder would be one of those. Not to steal would be another of them. We have seven Noahide laws. One of them is not to worship idols. So we have to figure out what constitutes idol worship. That's not so simple in today's world of religion. It was a lot simpler in older days when an idol looked like an idol. Today it's not so straightforward. But the question then would be, should we say, as long as people follow those, they can do what they want? Because we have on the books seven Noahide laws. Judith.
This is a little bit more spiritual, but the access point to another dimension can be seen like facets of a diamond. Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, all like the formats. And what is common for them all is what makes the diamond bright, which is light. So depending on where you are, you have a different access to that light, which I would say the other side, God, universe, consciousness, whatever. So people have access to it. You don't have to be, I would say, not have to be Jewish, but you have a different access depending on what your background is.
So Judith floats an idea that perhaps there could be a certain open-mindedness to approaches to other religions. And I think there can be, to a certain extent, but within Judaism there is an insistence on certain basics. There is an insistence on one God, creator of the universe, lives forever. Those sorts of things are basic within Judaism. And I think once you get beyond that, it becomes difficult to sustain within just basic Jewish teaching. Let's approach this a little bit differently, though. What's the point of a time of Mashiach, of a Tchiyat HaMetim, a return of the dead to this world?
Peace.
Peace? Is that really? I mean, let me ask the question a little bit more thoroughly. If we already have a belief in Judaism that after people pass away, they go on to another place, and that's a place of reward and a place of punishment and a place of proximity to God. And that's something that is anchored very clearly in Jewish texts going back to the beginning. The idea of people surviving their own death, so to speak, is one that you can find in biblical text. It's not discussed a whole lot, but if we had a different session on the topic, we can certainly demonstrate it. But my point is, if you already have that, why do people need to come back here at all? It's good that it'll be a peaceful time when they do. But why bother? Why not just say, when people pass away, they go to a place of reward or a place of punishment if they have to go through that first, whatever it is. What's the need for a messianic era at all? What's the kind of state that is being made with this philosophy? Yeah?
Everyone will be together again.
But they can be together there. Why do they need to be together here? Here you have to pay an electric bill.
Yeah. It will be a state for all the Jews in peace.
Okay, so it will be an opportunity for Jews to be able to come to the land of Israel. Fair, but why? Why that as opposed to just everybody goes to the next world and they can be close to God there? What's the need here? Yeah. It offers hope for a better world, but if I already promised a better world posthumously, so why do I need a better world here? Take a look at source number 3, because I think this really highlights it. A Mishnah lesson in Pirkei Avot. Rabbi Yaakov said, "This world is like a vestibule before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the vestibule so that you will enter the palace." Well, if this world is just the vestibule, why would I want to hang out in the vestibule? Why are you making a big party in the vestibule? Right? It's all very nice when, before you get into the main space at a dinner, they have a cocktail hour, right? But you don't really want to hang out in there all night. There's nowhere to sit down. Why are you doing that, right? Or you have at a wedding, so finally have hors d'oeuvres, and they circulate. That's all good, but like if there's no reception afterwards in the main room, people are going to go home disappointed. Why is it that we have to spend more time in the vestibule when we could just get into the palace. It seems a little bit odd. And I think the message that we're supposed to draw from it, I think what we're supposed to learn here is, for all that Pirkei Avot calls it a vestibule, the truth of the matter is that there is redeeming value here. There is religious value here. The world is not a place to be neglected. For a person to say, I have to do my time here, I'm sentenced to a period of time here, and then afterwards I get to go where I really want to go. But rather, this world is a redeemable place. This world is a place of value. And even if there are problems, and even if there are flaws around us, our task is not to say, so let me get out of here, you know, and get there. My task is to say, how can I fix here? Pirkei Avot is not wrong. Pirkei Avot is trying to emphasize a different religious value, which is, don't get hung up on materialism. Look at this world as a temporary place where you're going to spend your entire life trying to have a nicer house and a nicer car and a nicer vacation or whatever it is. And Pirkei Avot is combating a worldview that places too much emphasis on this world. But you don't want to go to the opposite extreme and say, there's no value here, because if that were true, we would have no idea of a Mashiach, there would be no idea of returning to this world, because you'd say, well, what's the point? Yeah. The danger in saying this world is just a vestibule for the next world and everything I want is really over there is, yes, it breeds a mindset of not just martyrdom, as in if they're going to kill me I will go out declaring Shema, but actually a willingness to throw out everything here and, in the extreme case, the suicide bomber. Because after all, everything they want is in the next world anyway. They don't want to be here in the first place. You're right. And that's a danger as well. But I think what Mashiach is doing, the concept of a messianic experience here, is to say, there's value here, on the physical plane, on the material plane, and don't throw that out in pursuit of the next world. Okay, so what, yeah?
The whole idea of, I may be off track here, having an anointed one, when it was first on here, positive,
yes, that's okay, I'm going to repeat it. Yeah.
And I know it's difficult for you to get the question.
No, I usually repeat it.
It's useless for us, if you don't mind. I'm sorry that I'm disturbing.
You're not disturbing, but the answer is going to end up being that I'm going to have just repeat the question as it's asked. Yeah. Yes. The anointed one. That's absolutely true. The question was, isn't the idea of anointed one something that was about a time when people were suffering and it was somebody who was meant to lead people out? But what I'm saying here is that the Mashiach, as posited in the Torah, is actually a this worldly thing. Mashiach is a human being, not an angel. It's somebody who, to go with Maimonides' description of what Mashiach's job description is somebody who will be a king, because he speaks in terms of monarchy, who's going to lead the people in the service of God, who's going to build the temple. That's what we're talking about here. It's a very this-worldly concept. It's not about saving people from the suffering of the world as much as it's about leading people to growth and leading the nation to growth. So if our idea... I'll take one more question, but then I'm going to go further because there's a lot to talk about. Yes?
It's always been my impression from childhood on that the Mashiach, I always, somebody must have said this to me, my parents perhaps, when Mashiach comes, we will be reunited with our lost, our family, that will receive us.
So the question was that it has often been said, and in your case, apparently, you know, you've been hearing it all your life,
yeah,
that when Mashiach comes, people will be reunited with their families. So what they're building on is not so much Mashiach as Tchiyat HaMeitim, the time when the dead return to life, and the, I'll say, safe assumption, whether it is or isn't, that they were all wonderful people, and therefore they're all coming back to enjoy this world. And those who aren't wonderful people, well, we didn't want to see them again anyway. I'm really going to go further, because there's just way too much to talk about. But what I'm trying to get at here is the following idea. That the image of a messianic time, before the dead return, when the dead return, whatever it is, speaks to the idea that this world is a perfectible place. That we're not trying to escape this world, rather we're trying to complete it. And if so, if that's true, shouldn't it include everybody coming to a recognition of God? Shouldn't that be part of it? And everybody coming to a recognition of certain basic ideas, and again, we're talking within Judaism, so it's going to be Judaism's conceptions of what God is and what this world is about. Certainly, rabbinic teaching seems to encourage the idea of people joining Judaism even before a messianic time, despite the fact that we've said we're not evangelical, right? I brought you in source number 4 one example of many, many examples that we could give. I actually thought I was bringing a different one on there, but I see I didn't. It's a fine. The one that I brought you there is good also. I just thought that I had actually included a different one. There's a midrash, the one I brought on here, and this is the one that that you'll look at in number 4, is about how God says to Abraham, "Hitalech lefanai, walk before me." When Abraham goes to the land of Canaan, which will become the land of Israel, God says, walk before me. And the midrash in number 4 says what that means is, God says, you know, Abraham, you're teaching about me anyway in the land of Canaan. Come teach about me in the land of Israel. There's another midrash, the one that I thought I was going to bring, which talks about Abraham teaching the men and Sarah teaching the women. And actually the language in the midrash, no, I didn't bring it here, is that they converted the men and the women of their time. They actually brought them to Judaism. There actually was a proselytizing element in their day. Not just that. If you take a look at source number 5, source number 5 is talking about the conversion process. Passage in the Talmud, 2,000 years ago, talks about what happens and how after a man, this case is a man, accepts Judaism, we circumcise him immediately. So the Talmud asks, what's the rush? Right? Don't you need to get bagels and lox? You have to get it together. Right? You have to pay rent at the shul. Like, why are you just rushing into this? To which the answer is, we do not delay a mitzvah. But that's really interesting, because it's framing conversion as a mitzvah. I didn't know that conversion was a mitzvah. That's really interesting. That means that it's something I should promote. We're supposed to pursue mitzvot. This is something we're supposed to want. If you take a look at source number 6, a passage in the Talmud states, the reason for our exile was in order to gain gerim, in order to gain converts, to get people to join us. Yeah, passage in the Talmud, it explains an awful lot. We're going to see the other side, because this is not a one-sided type of a topic. But I bring these sources to show you that in rabbinic writing, there's a strong desire for everybody to come to some recognition of God that even includes acceptance of Judaism. But it's not only rabbinic writing. Let's go to biblical predictions of the time of the Messiah. Let me ask you a question. If we wanted to describe... this is a good marker. I can already see it. It says jumbo on it. Okay. If we wanted to describe if we wanted a biblical text to predict that the world is going to be Jewish, that people are going to be practicing Judaism, What practices would we look for it to predict them engaging in? In other words, how would the text describe a Jewish world? What would people be doing? Shabbat, I heard. Hang on. I heard Shabbat. I heard keeping kosher. I heard mitzvot. I heard holidays. I heard Brit Milah, circumcision. Okay, these are a good representative sample, I think, of the things we would expect to see in that world. I heard Tzedakah mentioned also. That's also a good example. Well, take a look on your sheets, please, and you'll see something interesting, or at least interesting to me, and therefore you're stuck with it. Take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 also appears almost word for word in the prophet Isaiah. And it will be at the end of days. The mountain of the house of God will be established at the head of mountains and elevated above hills. And nations will stream there. Great nations will say, let us ascend to the mountain of God and the house of the God of Yaakov, of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways, we will walk in his paths. For Torah will come from Zion, and the word of God from Jerusalem. Right, that line from when we take out the Torah, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, is actually the non-Jews speaking about Torah coming from Zion. That's the way most read this sentence. So, here's a prediction. We're going to pause before the last sentence. The last sentence we have to come back to. But in the future, nations are described as coming to study Torah in Jerusalem. That's really interesting. Torah study was not on the list of things that people mentioned, but I think it is a Jewish activity, generally speaking. But let's go further. Take a look at source number 8. Source number 8 is a verse from Isaiah, a prediction of the apparent conversion of Egypt in the future. On that day, 5 cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan. Canaan is Israel. Why it's called Canaan there is a good discussion for another time. It's not for right now. They will swear by Hashem, Lord of multitudes. One of them shall be called City of Destruction. Also interesting for another time. On that day, there will be an altar of God in the land of Egypt, a monument for God at her border. It will be a sign and witness for Hashem, Lord of multitudes, in the land of Egypt. When they cry out to God before their oppressors, he will send them a redeemer and leader who will save them. And God will be known to Egypt, and Egypt shall know God on that day. They will serve God with sacrifices and gifts. They will bow to God and fulfill it. What you see here, prayer and karbanot, sacrifices. More than that, take a look at number 9. Also a prediction of the prophet Isaiah. And it will be at each month, right, Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the month. And on each Shabbat, all flesh will come to bow before me, declares God. So now we have everybody coming to pray to God at the site of the temple. And if you flip the page, not only Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh, but the holiday of Sukkot. Source number 10, Prophet Zechariah. And all who remain from all of the nations who ascended against Jerusalem will ascend annually to bow to the King, the Lord of multitudes, and to celebrate the holiday of Sukkot. Anyone know what happens in Jerusalem every year on Sukkot now?
The Tabernacles.
It is the Feast of the Tabernacles, but something specific happens. Yeah?
Christian groups come.
Christian groups come. There's a big parade. They call it the Parade of the 70 Nations. In Jerusalem every year because of this prediction in Zechariah. That's what they're doing. But here we have holidays being observed. Rosh Chodesh, Shabbat, holidays coming to the temple, and more. We're not done. Take a look at source number 11, going back to the prophet Isaiah. And the foreigners who join God to serve him and to love the name of God, to be his servants, all who guard Shabbat from desecration. They're observing Shabbat. And hold on to my covenant. I will bring them to my holy mountain, gladden them in the house of my prayer. Their burnt offerings and celebration offerings will be desired upon my altar. My house will be a house of prayer for all nations. Everyone.
That means that he's talking about calling. on birds only?
I don't know. You tell me what it sounds like. Right now we have observance of holidays. We have coming to the temple. We have prayer. We have bringing offerings. We have observance of Shabbat. We saw that in number 11. But there's more. We're not done. Take a look at source number 12. I feel like an infomercial. But wait, there's more. If you look at Zephaniah, another prophet, not as well known as Isaiah, then I will convert the nations to clear speech for all of them to call in the name of God, serving him with a united effort. Number 13. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your elders will dream dreams. Your youths will see visions. And upon the male and female servants at that time, I will pour out my spirit. Everybody becomes some form of prophet. Take a look at number 14, the last one in this segment. And in some sense, the most powerful of them. Actually, 14 and 15 go together. Sorry. But Isaiah predicts, on that day, Israel will be a triad with Egypt and Assyria, blessing in the midst of the land as God has blessed it, saying, blessed is my nation, Egypt, to the work of my hand, Assyria, my portion, Israel. God is calling Egypt and Assyria his chosen, his nation. It's a really remarkable thing. There is one commentator, and not a minor one either, who thinks it means the Jews who live in those lands. But most commentators assume, no, that's not what it means. It means Egypt and Assyria have the status of being God's nation as well. And now the last one, in number 15, prediction of the prophet Zechariah, many nations will join God on that day. They will be a nation for me. I will dwell among you. You will know that God, Lord of multitudes, sent me, Zechariah the prophet, to you. And when it says many nations will join God, the commentator Malbim in source number 16 says, they will convert and accept the religion of truth. Oh boy. So, you know, from our list here, we have Shabbat, we have various mitzvot, we have holidays. There actually was a line there about observing the covenant, whether that means the covenant of Brit Milah or some other covenant is not clear. We didn't specify kosher, but we did have mitzvot in general. Plus we had sacrifices, plus we had prayer, we had visiting the temple. These passages sound like they are predicting that everybody becomes Jewish. But that's only one side of the coin. Because there's always only one, there are always two sides of the coin. You can't have a one-sided coin. So let's argue the other way. I talked about the rabbinic writings about before the time of the Messiah, that there's already a desire for conversion. Well, tell me something. How many people did Abraham and Sarah convert? Eddie says, I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. But it does tell us something really interesting. Two generations later, the Jews go down to Egypt, and we get a census. 70 people go down to Egypt, right? There's some discussion in the census. Certain women are counted, men, whatever. But you get a number of 70. All of them biological relatives of Jacob. Whatever people are being converted by Abraham and Sarah, they're not there. Now, you could say, well, maybe they're there, but they're not listed in the census, but I think that defeats the purpose of the census. Oops. Okay, then. Did I do that? Let's see. Back on. Ah. Okay. You could say that, for whatever reason, they're not counted in that census. But it's really interesting that we never find any record of who these additional people are. And we don't seem to see them endure. We know that Abraham had people in the household, right? When he goes to war to save Lot, there are other people who are listed. But we don't find an enduring sense that they become Jewish, become part of the Jewish people. Conversion may be considered a mitzvah, but we've said we don't evangelize, and as a matter of fact, I brought it for you on the sheet in source number 17. If someone comes to convert in our day, we say to him, what did you see that caused you to come convert? Do you not know that Israel today is in mourning, pushed around, drowned and torn and beset by suffering? We're not making a sales pitch here. If you really believe that we want people to become Jewish, there are better ways to do it. This isn't like reverse psychology. The more terrible we tell them it is, the more likely they are to want to join. It sounds like it's not really what we want. And not just that. Go back to the passage of Micha that I brought you in source number 7. The third verse there that I said we're going to come back to has a very interesting hidden message. Menachem Begin was the one who pointed this out. I thought it was a brilliant insight. Well, and if you're looking at source number 7, you want the fourth line, the middle of the line. And he will judge, he, the Messiah, will judge between many nations. He will clarify for mighty nations, even those from afar. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not raise up sword against nation, no longer shall they learn war. Right? We're familiar with this line. We like this? Yes? Yeah?
I find it's all very interesting. It's very political.
Oh, extremely so.
It's unbelievable.
Isaiah was very political. That's a problem. I have to know more about Isaiah. We don't have time for it right now. But remember, some of our prophets addressed a rural population. Other prophets spoke to an urban population. Isaiah's audience, his chief audience, are the royalty of his day. He was part of the royal family, and they are his targets. He talks about issues of relations with foreign governments. He talks about whether to go to war, not go to war. Yes, his messages are targeted towards those who are the political leadership. Yeah.
That's never.
Invalid. We can't do it. Yeah, there's no such thing as forced conversion within Judaism. What you may be remembering is that in the book of Esther, after Mordechai has already been recognized by the king, the text says, V'rabim me'amei ha'aretz mityahadim, ki nafal pachad ha'yehudim aleihem. That many people from the nations became Jewish. They were mityahed. They became Yehudim. They became Jewish out of fear of Mordechai. But that wasn't something that we imposed. That's something that they themselves saw which way the wind was blowing. They became Raptors fans. You know what I'm saying? So,
thank you.
Sure. So if you take a look at source number 18, Menachem Begin was the leader of the Chevrut party in the early years of the state. And in 1951, the second convention of his Chevrut party, he articulated the platform of the party in a speech that lasted, I think it was 3 hours. Because they did that in those days. Fortunately, it was then written up and translated, and it's available online. But look at this piece of his platform. One of the major points he was doing back in those days, this is 1951, was arguing against the policies of David Ben-Gurion and the labor government. Right? He was in opposition to the government. The labor government was heavily socialist, and he was so anti-socialist. And one of the points that he makes here is, you shouldn't envision a world in which all divisions and all separate identities and classes and so forth disappear. He says it ain't so. And he says, look at Tanakh, look at Scripture. Israel's prophets and seers, from whom we have inherited the aspiration for justice that guide our repose, elevated visions that are very difficult to realize. Their vision is a vision of truth. Because even beyond the historical horizon, beyond the end of days, they did not promise to abolish any difference. Indeed, at the end of days, nation will not raise sword against nation, but even then, there will be many nations. And while at the end of days, devouring hatred will disappear for, quote, the wolf will lie down with the lamb. But even then, the differences between one species and another will not be eliminated. There are still wolves. There are still lambs. In other words, if one expands the symbolic meaning of the metaphor, the differences between a person and his fellow will not disappear with the desired disappearance of the hatred between them. It's a really important insight. I had never heard anybody point that out until then. The The point for us, though, is if you think everybody is going to convert to Judaism, then why are there, in fact, different nations? I think it's a valid point. Not only that, if you go back to the biblical text, source number 19, Zechariah once again, and all who remain, he's describing what will happen in the future after an Armageddon, essentially, a great war that will be waged. All who remain from all of the nations who ascended against Jerusalem will ascend annually to bow to the king, we saw this before already, the Lord of multitudes, and to celebrate the holiday of Sukkot. And he who does not ascend to Jerusalem from the nations of the land to bow before the king, they will not receive rain. And if the nation of Egypt shall not ascend and not approach, will not the plague with which God will strike the nations who do not ascend to celebrate Sukkot be upon them? Aren't they going to experience the same? This shall be the sin of Egypt and the sin of all nations which do not ascend to celebrate Sukkot. In other words, yes, there are some who will show up, and there are some who won't show up. And they may have consequences for it, but it means not everybody's joining in. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, in his 11th century commentary in source number 20, based on verses in Zechariah, says, yeah, it's about two-thirds, one-third. One-third is the group that will recognize God, the other two-thirds, not so much. The truth of the matter is that we don't necessarily have predictions of everybody converting. We may have predictions of some people joining and some people not. Also worth noting, a verse I quoted you from Esther had a very particular language to describe what's going to happen in the future. Well, not what happened. What happened at the time of Esther. When it described people converting, it actually said, "Rabim me'amei haaretz mityahadim," that the nations were mityahed, they became Jews. We have not seen that kind of language in biblical texts. We saw it in commentators. But we have not seen an explicit language of converting. And here we get two sources that I think make it abundantly clear. Take a look at source number 21. I have to explain 21. 21 requires a little bit of commentary. The Talmud talks about what's going to happen in the future, and it's building on the verses we've already seen at the end of Zechariah. The verses about the nations coming to celebrate Sukkot. The Talmud is bothered by a question that I am sure most of you, if not everybody here, has to be wondering about, which is, why Sukkot? I mean, it's a nice holiday. It's a good holiday. But, like, why not Pesach? Let them all do Pesach. Let's see how that goes. Shavuos, right? I could make an argument for Passover. Because that's when we got out of Egypt. We were formed. It was the recognition of God's hand in the world. That makes sense. I could make an argument for Shavuot. Right? Either because of the biblical reference to bringing the first fruit, you're bringing your produce to God, everybody should do that, or because we celebrate on Shavuot the giving of the Torah at that time, so makes sense, they should also celebrate God giving Torah to humanity, that makes sense too. Sukkot, the holiday of our passage in the wilderness, what does it have to do with them? Why would they be celebrating it? So the Talmud gives you a fascinating story. Talmud says, you have to get the backstory on this. And the backstory is that in the future, God is going to want to reward those who had, in fact, observed the commandments. However, the rest of the nations are going to say, that's not fair. You didn't give us the Torah. If you had given us the Torah, we would have observed the commandments also. And God is going to say to them, okay, here's the deal. I am going to give you a mitzvah. Take a look at, number 21 is with that, but not yet that. So hang on 21 for a second. God is going to say to them, here is the holiday of Sukkot. It's an easy mitzvah in the sense that a sukkah doesn't have to be expensive, right? There are expensive ones. You can get fiberglass and pop-up and God knows what. But you can also just take, leftover wood and put it together that way. So God says, all right, go observe Sukkot and let's see how you do. And the Talmud has a whole discussion of what happens. But take a look at number 21. As part of that address, they said, they're going to say to God, Master of the universe, give it to us from the start. Give us the Torah from the beginning and we'll do it. And God said back to them, world-class fools, shotim shabbat olam is the Hebrew. One who worked before Shabbat shall eat on Shabbat. One who didn't work before Shabbat, how shall he eat on Shabbat? Meaning, what, all along, you didn't bother. Now you're going to do it. And I bring this story because it seems to say that no, they don't become Jewish. They're not going to be accepted with everybody else. That's one. But the strongest one is source number 22. Our sages thought, we do not accept converts in the time of Mashiach. Similarly, they didn't accept converts in the time of David or the time of Solomon. Now, the truth of the matter is there were converts in the time of Solomon. We know that because Solomon had a whole bunch of political marriages to women from the nations of the region. And we are taught, Maimonides and others say, there was some form of conversion that went on. So it's not an ironclad rule. But the fact that we're being told here that there's no conversion in the time of the Messiah seems to say fairly clearly that there's no conversion in the time of the Messiah. They're not going to become Jewish. So how do we make sense of this? We now have, first of all, why wouldn't we accept converts in the time of the Messiah? What's the rationale for that last source? Why wouldn't we accept converts in the time of the Messiah, or David and Solomon for that matter? Sorry? Right, sorry? Right. There's a fear that if people come to us when we're doing well, it's not going to be, boy, this is a beautiful religion we really want in. It's going to be, they're on top right now, we're going to ride the bandwagon. It's not a sincere acceptance of the religion. That's the fear. That's what this is about. But let's look at this now and try to figure out how we make sense of this. Because what we have seem to be conflicting messages. On the one hand, one side of the ledger, we have the sources that are rabbinic, that speak about the value of having people convert to Judaism, calling it a mitzvah. God wants Abraham and Sarah to go out there and convert people. These are positive. We were exiled in order for people to be attracted to Judaism, to learn from the model that they observe. That's one. Number two, we had biblical predictions that spoke about people observing mitzvot, observing Shabbat, observing the holidays, coming to the temple, bringing sacrifices. Those look like Jewish behavior. They really do. And then on the flip side, we noted that these rabbinic sources are not so ironclad. They don't use the language of conversion. We have the fact that we have rabbinic sources that discourage conversion as well. So we've got rabbinic arguments on this side. We have biblical verses that indicate that not everybody converts in the future, right? Like we talked about there being separate nations, even in the future. We're able to bring sources that indicate against. And then we have what I consider to be the best source against, the passage in the Talmud that says there is no such thing as conversion in the time of the Messiah. You simply can't do it. That's a very good source. And then on the other hand, we had what we talked about in terms of the time of the Messiah and the goal of that period of the Messiah, which is perfection of this world. And why shouldn't that be something that is for everybody? Why should that just be about us? Shouldn't everybody be drawn to God, drawn to a recognition of the principles of Judaism? Why shouldn't it be for everybody? We have a problem. What's the easiest solution? Besides, Jews debate everything, go on. Besides that answer, what's the easiest solution? Yeah.
Everybody to their own religion, but peace.
Everybody to their own religion, but peace. But that doesn't help me with the idea that the world is supposed to be perfected in this Jewish vision. They're not going to have this Jewish vision then. Sorry, there was another hand that I didn't see where it was. I saw that there wasn't.
It was me, but I was going to say the same
thing. You're going to say the same thing. I think that's hard to really match. The easiest answer that I would give would be to say, I need to go on to a third page. Marjorie, do we have a budget for this? We're good?
I hope so.
Okay.
What about...
So the easiest answer that I would give, hang on, is to say two groups. Some people will convert, and some people won't. Some yes, some no. We already articulated that before. Ibn Ezra with his one-third versus two-thirds. That's the easiest answer, is to say some do, some don't. Yes?
If you mean the two groups, it means that some of them will convert just for their own will, from their own idea that it will be good for them, and some will be idealistic about it.
That's interesting. The idea that some people will become Jewish sincerely, and some for self-gain. It's an interesting idea as well, to put within the two groups idea. I'm not sure it would fit with everything, like with the source that said there's no conversion. And I don't know how that will deal with this either. If you say that there's no conversion, that means there's none. Not that there are some people who do and some people who don't. But that's one approach. A second approach that you could offer, and this was my initial idea when I first started thinking about the topic, would be to say, you don't have to convert to Judaism to like Levi's Rider. No, you don't have to convert to Judaism in order to recognize God. Meaning, there is a spectrum here. At one, someone else said that? Judith said, oh, that was what you were trying to say before. Okay, I think we may be talking about different parts of the spectrum, but fine with the idea in general. Here you have at least what I'm trying to present. One end of the spectrum, to be a Jew. Opposite end of the spectrum, we'll say, is to worship idols. Whatever you want to define idols to be is a topic for another time. But idols are the other end of the spectrum. But in the middle, you have the category of, and this goes back to something that was mentioned, I think, in the beginning, the seven mitzvot that apply to all human beings. Not to kill, not to steal, not to worship idols, not to commit adultery, not to blaspheme. These are the, you know, more or less the basics. And maybe the answer is there's no goal of getting everybody to convert. And in fact, we're not looking for people to convert. What we're looking for is for the world to come to a recognition of God such that they observe these seven mitzvot. And that's sufficient. Tell me, anybody know the term of the Torah for somebody who observes the seven mitzvot? Not Noahites. There's a term in Hebrew. The term is ger toshav. The term is ger toshav, and what it means is a stranger who settles in Israel. When the Jews initially come to the land of Israel, when the Jews first come into the land of Israel, they are told, there's a problem in this land. The Canaanites have created a horrible society. It is an abusive society. If you think of the city of Sodom, if you think of the city of Shechem, where the leader kidnapped and raped Dinah, this is a society that God says, I can't have this. This cannot be allowed to persist. Whether the Jews come into the land or do not come into the land, God says, I'm destroying it. I've had enough. But he says to the Jews, there's one more chance. If you come into this land and you represent the Torah that I am teaching you, the ideals that I am teaching you, the nations will be drawn from this model to accept the seven Noahide laws, and then they can remain. The Jews are meant to come into the land and effectively be models. Not for people to become Jewish, but for people to recognize God. If you take a look at number 24 on your sheet, I'll come back to explain 23. But 24, Rabbi, I did it again. Rabbi, hang on. Oh, wait. Just a second. 24, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook. He said, were it not for the sin of the golden calf, the inhabitants of the land of Israel would have been reconciled with the people of Israel. For the name of God called upon them would have aroused awe, no war would have been necessary. All those wars that you see when the Jews come into the land were not what was supposed to happen. What was supposed to happen was we were supposed to be proper examples of what it means to serve God. And we were supposed to be inspiring. Then we worship the golden calf. Then we had the sin of the spies. And all the problems along the way. And, you know, we come into the land as a nation like that, and they say, well, you're something we're supposed to emulate. It doesn't work that way. That's what Rabbi Cook is pointing out. But what we're seeing here is that's the goal for the future, is to be, again, the nation we were meant to be in the first place. No one has to convert. They're just supposed to be inspired to come to God. And that's a second approach. And then I have a third approach. And this will be the last one. The third approach is to suggest that it goes back to what I said in the very beginning, which is that you have different eras. Remember we said in the beginning, there's a time of the Messiah, and then there's a time of the resurrection of the dead. Sorry, not resurrection, return of the dead to life. Right? That was what we said? Maybe the answer is really that simple. I brought you in source number 23 a link to a website where they actually have a whole discussion of what's supposed to be in the time of the future. What exactly that world is going to look like. And I didn't have the time in this session for us to discuss all the different views. Maybe that's a session for next year at some point. I don't know. But maybe the answer really is much more straightforward. In other words, these are good answers, that there are different groups, or the answer that we're just looking for people to recognize God. But maybe the answer really is the time of the Messiah is a first stage. That's when we become the nation we are supposed to become. We come to a recognition of God. We create a world in which there is peace, in which there is an end to tyranny. That's a first stage, and it's an important stage. And then there is another layer. Then there is a world in which everybody becomes prophets, and those who have passed away return, and Tchiyat HaMetim, all of that, as predicted there, is the next stage. And in that world, then yes, then everybody comes to Judaism. That's an idea. Now, look, everything that I have said to this point is drawn from traditional Jewish text. Without a doubt, someone who is not Jewish may look at this and say, well, maybe I don't want to become a Jew. Why do you think that you have the right to say that your way is, as one of the commentators before said, the religion of truth? But that's what religions do. Religions believe that they have an insight into what is supposed to be, that we were given a message, and we can be respectful of everybody, but it doesn't mean that we deny this is who we are, this is where we're coming from, this is what we've been taught. And so what I see in this is a belief that, as we said before, this world is a perfectible place. For all of the flaws, for all of the problems, this vestibule, to use the term used in Pirkei Avot, is a place with its own value. And what we are taught is, it can be perfected, and it will be. That's the promise that we're given over and over again in Scripture. Whether it happens in one stage, whether it happens in multiple stages, whether it happens with everybody becoming Jewish, some people becoming Jewish, just recognizing God as Ger Tushav and keeping the seven mitzvot, whatever is the right answer, that remains to be seen. But our task is to do what we can to bring the world of perfection, the world that is redeemed, a step closer. Thank you very much.